Chapter 49. Martyrs. If the definition of a martyr is someone who's willing to suffer and die for a belief, then the family of Harold Alexander undoubtedly qualifies. On the afternoon of December the 22nd, 1970, two police officers and a doctor forced their way into a locked apartment in the Calais Jesús Nazareno in Santa Cruz, the capital of Tenerife in the Canary Islands. The blinds were drawn, but even in the half-light it was possible to see that walls, doors, furniture were covered with blood. The detective sergeant pointed to a lump of flesh that had been skewered on a wooden stake. "My God, what's that?" The doctor peered at it closely and then turned away. A human heart. There were three dead women in the apartment, two young girls and an older woman, their mother. All three had been beaten, a blood-stained hammer and other tools lay nearby. The bodies had been hacked open and the hearts extracted. Each of these had been pierced with a wooden stake. The two men who had committed this slaughter were at present in police custody. They had given themselves up willingly. Harold Alexander was a middle-aged German who had moved to Tenerife with his family 10 months earlier. He and his 16-year-old son Frank had walked to the apartment of Dr. Walter Trenkler on that afternoon just before Christmas. Their daughter, 15-year-old Sabine, worked there. Harold Alexander asked to see his daughter and then put his arm around her and told her in a calm voice that he and Frank had just killed her mother and two sisters. The girl raised her father's hand fondly to her cheek and said, "I'm sure you've done what you thought was necessary." The horrified Dr. Trenkler, who overheard all this, rushed to the telephone and called the German consul. An hour later, the police had discovered the mutilated bodies of Alexander's wife, Dagmar, his eldest daughter, Marina, who was 18, and Petra, who was 15, Sabine's twin. Back at the police headquarters, it was the son, Frank, who spoke first. He explained that his mother had been giving him a strange look, which had made him uncomfortable. He picked up a coat hanger and began to beat her until she fell unconscious. His father didn't interfere. On the contrary, he picked up a heavy spirit level and began to bludgeon Marina and Petra. None of the three women screamed or made the slightest attempt to escape. They knew that all this was ordained, for their brother, Frank, was, according to their father, the representative of God on earth. As to Harold Alexander, he explained to the police that when he saw Frank beating his mother with a coat hanger, he knew that the hour of killing had arrived. "My son is a prophet," he said. "He is inspired by God." And so the two men carefully battered their womenfolk to death. The women cried, not because they were unwilling to die, but because it hurt them to be hit. When they were dead, father and son took it in turn to complete the work of mutilation. They did this one at a time. First, Frank played the organ while his father worked, and then his father took over while Frank hacked at the naked breasts of his sisters. They then wrote notes expressing such sentiments as, "To be truly free, you must kill those whom you love more than anything else." Clearly, Harold and Frank Alexander were suffering from religious mania, and so apparently was Sabine, who sobbed when she was told that she could not go to prison with her father and brother. But how had this come about? The Santa Cruz police contacted the police of Hamburg, the last city of residence of the Alexander family, and from them they learned that the family originated in Dresden, but had fled from the Russians. Alexander was the disciple of wheelwright George Rieler. One day, many years earlier, Rieler had suddenly become possessed by the conviction that he was a prophet of God, and had become a travelling preacher. Rieler himself was a follower of another prophet of God, Jakob Lorber, who in the first half of the 19th century had founded a religious group known as the Lorber Society, who observed the most rigid ascetic disciplines. Alexander had remained with Rieler until his death, nursing him, and had inherited from him the small organ on which he and his son had played after the massacre of their family. A doctor who knew them in Hamburg reported that the family had very little contact with the outside world. They seemed to live for one another and for their religion. Neighbours in the Calais Jesús Nazareno said the same thing. Since the family had moved in, they had lived behind drawn blinds. The only sounds that came from the house were the playing of the organ, presumably a part of interminable religious services. The twins worked for Dr. Trenkler, but the doctor had had no opportunity to get to know them better. They did their work, but they remained totally aloof. Presumably they felt that the outside world was hopelessly damned. What did they have in common with the other members of our doomed society? So when their work was finished, they returned home to the darkened apartment and to the religious services. They worshipped their brother as a prophet, because their father said that he was, and they were perfectly prepared to die when God sent a sign, so their souls could leave behind the dross of this earth and wing their way to heaven. Father and son were committed to an asylum for the criminally insane, and yet there were doctors in Santa Cruz who doubted whether, in the strict sense of the word, they were insane. They had convinced themselves that they were a tiny body of the elect in a world that was damned, and they had lived out their belief with rigid logic. If they were insane, was Hitler also insane for the insistence with which he followed his belief that the Jews were the cause of most of the troubles of the human race? What distinguishes fanaticism from insanity? This raises one of the most fascinating problems known to psychology, the problem of the human capacity for religious conviction and the way it can turn men into martyrs. For we are here faced with a strange enigma. When we see moths flying into an electric bulb or a candle flame, we do not call them insane. We recognise that this is a natural reflex that compels moths to seek the light. There can be no doubt that human beings experience an equally powerful intensity to seek the light, that is, any form of intensity or strong feeling. They crave for a deep sense of meaning. African natives drum themselves into a kind of trance to the beating of the tom-tom. Teenagers in discotheques achieve a kind of hypnotic frenzy, dancing to stroboscopic lights and deafening music. Crowds scream themselves hoarse, listening to a dictator. Armies achieve a sense of absolute certainty of purpose as they march to military music. Men hunger for strong conviction, as an alcoholic craves strong drink. They long to be possessed, and in a state of possession, they are able to kill or to be killed. The history of religious possession can be traced back many thousands of years. For example, we know that well before 1000 BC, the wild highlanders to the north of Greece, in the land called Thrace, worshipped a god called Dionysus, who took the form of a bull. His worship involved violent orgies and the sacrifice of an animal, or even a child, by tearing it to pieces. Homer mentions the god as Raging Dionysus. But then he knew very little about him, for it was several centuries after Homer that the god Dionysus came to Greece and swept everything before him. The ancient Greeks were a serious, sober, intelligent people, and their chief god, Apollo, was also serious and severe, the god of form and discipline and virtue. Suddenly, in about the 7th century BC, the heathen Dionysus arrived. Under the name of Bacchus, he was the god of wine, and significantly, he was also the god of sex. One of his symbols was an erect penis with a pair of testicles. The historian of religion, B.Z. Goldberg, has a remarkable description of a Dionysian festival, beginning with a procession carrying torches, led by musicians and women carrying fruit. Men carried wooden penises, while women might carry images of the female sexual organs. In a lonely spot in the woods, the image of Dionysus was taken from its chest. A hog was sacrificed as a burnt offering, and the feast began with ritualistic drinking of wine. Men and women threw off their clothes. Women provoked men by making lithe sexual movements of the breasts and pelvis. Excited men seized them and thrust into them. Naked bodies writhed on the ground. Women threw themselves into the waters of the bay holding lighted torches and were convinced that the torches continued to burn. Men plunged in after them and copulated in the sea. Children were grabbed and initiated into the orgy of drunkenness and sex, and finally, as day broke, the exhausted people, staggered and reeling, made their way back to the town, both men and women feeling that they had drained themselves of sexual energy in the worship of their god. Goldberg's account cannot be substantiated in detail. We have no documents describing such orgies at first hand, but the records we do possess suggest that this account may be an understatement rather than an exaggeration. Dionysus could induce madness. King Lycurgus, who opposed him, killed his own son with an axe. King Pentheus, another unbeliever, was torn to pieces by his own mother, who was possessed by a bacchanalian frenzy. Dionysus was not simply the god of total abandonment, he was also the god of dark violence. This is understandable enough, but what is altogether more baffling is that many of the later forms of Dionysic religion were rigidly puritanical. There was a Russian sect called the Khailisti, founded by a Christ called Daniel Filipov. He was a peasant and a deserter from the army. And in the year 1645 he was standing on the hill of Golodina in Vladimir when a god whom he called Zebaot descended into his body like a flash of lightning, and Daniel Filipov realized that he had been chosen to be God's representative on earth. At the same time, Russia was split with violent religious dissension, for the Tsar Alexis, who might be compared to England's Henry VIII, had made changes in the prayer book and rituals which had enraged the old believers, who sometimes burnt themselves to death on giant bonfires rather than give way. Daniel Filipov was crucified twice and still survived. He preached a stern ascetic religion, a kind of super-Puritanism, and yet the central rite of the Chailisti was a ceremony that sounds very like the Dionysian orgies. The worshippers, dressed in white robes, danced around a great cauldron of water in some forest grove, chanting rhythmically, flagellating one another with rods. When the Holy Spirit descended, they would begin to chant in strange tongues, and the water in the cauldron would take on a golden colour and begin to boil of its own accord. Finally, they lost all individual consciousness, and it was at this point, according to their detractors, that they tore off their clothes and copulated freely, mothers with sons, brothers with sisters. The Chailisti themselves denied that such things happened, but the Orthodox Church was sufficiently convinced to make it a serious offence to belong to the Chailisti. Rasputin, the monk who exercised such a powerful influence on the last of the Tsars and his wife, was reputed to belong to the Chailisti, and legends of his insatiable sexual appetite seem to support this view. Another Russian sect, the Skoptsi, were even more fanatical. They developed from the Chailisti. A woman called Akhalina Ivanovna was worshipped as the Chailisti Mother of God around about the year 1770. She recognized a man called Kondraty Selivanov as a reincarnation of Christ. This recognition seems to be a feature of extremist religious sects, as in the case of Harold Alexander and his son. Selivanov soon became the leader of the Chailisti and announced new disciplines. All men should be castrated, and all women should have their breasts and outer genital organs amputated. Selivanov led the way by castrating himself with a red-hot iron. It should have been a certain formula for losing all his followers, but on the contrary, religious fanatics found themselves irresistibly attracted to the idea of self-mutilation. The authorities were worried about this wave of religious frenzy. Selivanov was arrested and placed in a mental home. But his followers continued to worship him, and when he was released in 1801, when Alexander I came to the throne, he had become even more influential. Strangely enough, many of his disciples came from among the wealthy. He claimed to be Tsar Peter III, murdered by his wife Catherine the Great, and he castrated or mutilated 100 men and women with his own hands. Even after his death in 1830, his followers refused to believe that he was dead. Like Jesus, he had only withdrawn, and would return to earth on the day that his followers numbered 144,000 and inaugurate the Day of Judgment. Skoptsi communities continued to flourish. Children born into the sect grew up in the knowledge that they would be mutilated when they reached puberty. According to the great authority on Russian sects, Frederick Konybeare, anyone who tried to escape by fleeing was hunted down and assassinated. B.Z. Goldberg adds that for some men and women, mutilation was only partial. Some women could escape with only one nipple. These sometimes became communal prostitutes, whose business was to earn money for the common treasury. Some Russian sects went further than the Skoptsi and demanded suicide as a religious duty. In the reign of Alexander II, a man named Shodkin founded a suicide sect and led his followers into a cave, which they proceeded to seal up. Two women became panic-stricken and broke out. Shodkin then called upon his followers to kill one another before the police arrived. The children were murdered first, and then the women. When the police arrived, Shodkin and two of his acolytes were surrounded by dozens of bleeding corpses. Normal, rational people are inclined to explain such strange events in terms of the human capacity for self-destruction. But this would be an oversimplification. A man may fall violently in love with a girl, or at least feel an overwhelming desire, while disliking many things about her. His sexual instincts are fixed upon her, while his reason rejects her. There is often the same ambiguity in religion. Man's reason cannot satisfy his need for food or his need for exercise. Neither can it satisfy his craving for religion, for some deep, strong belief. Such beliefs express themselves in symbols. In Christianity, the central symbol is the death of Jesus on the cross. A character in a novel of Dostoevsky's says that if he had to choose between truth and salvation on the one hand and Jesus and damnation on the other, he would unhesitatingly choose Jesus. Sometimes the obsession with the image of the cross may become so great that the worshipper may pray to suffer the wounds of Christ, like St. Francis, or may actually try to crucify himself. In the early 19th century, a shoemaker of Venice named Matthew Lovett decided to crucify himself in public. Lovett was the son of poor peasants, and his poverty made it impossible for him to carry out his ambition of entering the church. One day he castrated himself with his shoemaker's knife. After this he made a wooden cross, carrying it into the street, and was in the process of nailing his feet to it when a passerby intervened and stopped him. Lovett went back to his native village of Casale, and this time made a more elaborate arrangement for self-crucifixion. In his third-story room, he constructed a large cross with a bracket to support his feet. He also slung a net over the cross to support his weight in case the bracket gave way. Early one morning, he attached the cross by a rope to a long beam of the ceiling and placed its lower end on the windowsill. Then he carefully climbed up onto the cross and with one violent blow of a mallet drove a nail through both feet and into a hole that he'd prepared for it. Then he used his hands, which were free, to edge the cross out of the window. It slipped and hung suspended above the street. He had already hammered a nail through the palm of his right hand and prepared a hole for it in the cross. Now he nailed his left hand to the cross, dropped the hammer, and tried to guide the nail into the hole prepared for it. However, shock had made him too weak, and he hung there, his right hand by his side, until the horrified citizens came and hauled him in again. He was not dead. In fact, he spent the remainder of his life in a mental home. In this case, we can see with great clarity how the religious compulsion can sometimes gain the intensity of a sexual obsession. The necrophile, Sergeant Bertrand, would swim in an icy stream at night and dig the ground with his bare hands until they were bleeding in order to reach the female corpses he craved. Matthew Lovett probably experienced no pain as he nailed himself to the cross, only a kind of intense sexual pleasure, of the same kind that leads certain sexual perverts to hang themselves in women's underwear. It may seem almost sacrilegious to ask where we draw the line between this kind of obsession and a saint's passionate desire for suffering that causes the stigmata of Christ to appear on his hands and feet. The human psyche is full of strange forces, most of which we do not even suspect, and it may be many centuries more before psychologists even begin to understand them. One of the strangest of all cases of martyrdom is that of a whole South African tribe, the Xhosas, in 1857. The Xhosas were warriors who hated British rule. One morning in 1856, a young Xhosa girl who went to fetch water at the river became convinced that she had seen strange men. Her uncle also saw them and recognised among them a brother who had died many years before. These spirits of the dead explained that they had come to help the Xhosas destroy the white men, and first they had to eat all their cattle and then destroy their food. When everything had been destroyed, the dead would rise to help them, the fields would fill with ripe corn, and the day of heaven on earth would arrive. More than 100,000 Xhosas obeyed, killing their cattle and destroying their corn. The reasonable ones among them were subjected to such intense psychological pressure from the others that they did as they were told, and then died of starvation. When all food stocks had been destroyed, the exhausted Xhosas spent the night dancing and rejoicing, convinced that in the morning two blood-red suns would arise and signal that the heavens were about to open. Only one sun arose. They were stunned. Some thought that perhaps it was the wrong day. They waited another day. And still only one sun arose. And then hordes of the weary Xhosas dragged themselves towards British territory looking for food. Of 105,000 Xhosas, 68,000 died horribly of slow starvation. The lives of the remainder were only saved by stocks of government food. It was the end of the great power of the Xhosa tribe. Yet, although martyrdom seems a form of madness, we must remember that it's men of deep and passionate conviction who have helped the human race to its present place on the evolutionary scale. Without such men, there would be no future. In fact, the scriptures may be scientifically accurate when they say that the blood of martyrs fertilizes the earth.